Life Audio.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined as always in studio by my good friend, my partner in radio, Barnabas Piper. Pipe, you have been on death's door this week, but because you're a radio pro, and because we're really radio pros now, given some of the things that are happening on our show, which we'll get into momentarily, you have rallied to be in the studio. Ronald, meanwhile, is doing what Ronald does best, which is being somewhere else and lounging and not doing a whole lot. So what do we know about where Ronald is? Let's start there.
He's in Hilton Head, I believe. Uh-huh. And I feel safe saying that because I know our swarms of fans would want to just flock to where he is. But by the time releases, he probably won't be in Hilton Head anymore. I think it was for a period of vacating and then a period of retreating, which I don't know what the difference is, except one is vacating with no agenda and the other is vacating with an agenda or something along those lines.
Interesting. Yeah, that may be interesting to have him flesh out those distinctions on the air at some point.
Have you ever wondered, with as many retreats as he goes on, what is he retreating from? Because I feel like, you know, in the history of the world, retreating is generally, it's like a withdrawal.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Strategic withdrawal, we just got our butts kicked withdrawal, something. What is he retreating from?
Yeah, that's a great question. Like, if you're always retreating, are you ever retreating? And there's got to be like some Zen nugget of wisdom in there somewhere. Which he's kind of trying to position himself as like Zen guy. So maybe, you know, maybe he fleshes that out in a tweet with a lot of like hard returns in it, and gets like 15 likes.
And man, who knows, maybe Beth Moore will respond to this one.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. I think he takes all these retreats hoping to maybe run into Beth Moore one day. maybe their paths will cross.
And yet oddly, he never goes to Houston. I mean, it's not that odd. I've been to Houston, but still.
Yeah, I think Houston is not quite like hipster or glamorous enough for Ronald. Also, shout out Houston. I feel like per capita, Houston may have more famous Christians in it than any other single metro area, which is strange given the existence of like, you know, Grand Rapids and Wheaton and some of the other meccas that we kind of attribute to this. Have you ever thought about that?
Probably not per capita, but like per big hair or something. Like there's a certain kind. And there's a certain, like, everything is bigger in Texas that I don't know if that's actually true, but the personas are certainly true. And there's definitely some monster personas in the Houston area.
Yeah. Pipe, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I got one more Ronald thing, and then we'll get into two really interesting topics. Let's take a break.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
All right, Pipe, we're back. A day or two ago, I shared with you something, and it was a link to Irwin Raphael McManus's clothing line, where you can purchase like a single sock for $45 or like a really garish hoodie for like $1,200.
A hoodie that looks like it was comprised of patches stolen from the hoodies of 11 homeless men.
Exactly.
Like, you basically cut swatches off of poor people's clothes and sewed them together and sold them for $1,000.
I buried the lead on that whole thing, though, and I kind of hate myself for it taking me 48 hours to get to this joke. But The most obvious thing about it to me was how much Erwin Raphael McManus looks like Ron. Like, their Venn diagrams aesthetically are, like, kind of creeping toward the middle. And it's almost hard to distinguish the two. So the question is,
would Ronnie have become this had he stayed in Southern California, which happens to be where Erwin Raphael McManus lives?
I think Ronnie would like to become this. I actually think the Erwin McManus kind of, like, faux arty, sort of ethereal aesthetic, he's got an unlimited budget to work with. I mean, I think in Ron's wildest dreams, that's who he is.
I'm just hung up on the phrase unlimited budget to work with. Like, having worked in the Christian nonprofit and ministry spaces for almost my entire adult life,
yeah,
that it just doesn't register. And I know it's a reality in certain swaths of Christendom.
Yeah.
But goodness, that's weird.
It really is. Yeah. It's hard to even think about it. And employed as I am at a small private Christian college, unlimited budget is not not even a glimmer in our eye as well. But Pipe, speaking of budgets and business and commerce, we are a few episodes in now to our partnership with Salem Audio, and we're getting some fascinating feedback on the types of ads that are running during the ad breaks. I have thoughts on that, but I want to hear from you just a rundown of, like, what types of things are people reporting to you on this?
Yeah, so one of my favorite things are the tweets and Facebook messages and Instagram messages we get weekly from people. I'd say 80% are amused, 20% are somewhere between annoyed and outraged that we've sold our souls to the devil. And by sold, I mean we're waiting to get paid.
Yeah, we haven't seen penny once.
So
But
yeah, so what they are is, hey, did you guys know you're running ads for?
Yeah.
And so here are a few of the things that have come across our transom, to use a TED phrase. sports books, so betting on sports. Casinos, particularly a local one in somewhere in Louisiana.
Great.
Psychic clinics.
Oh,
psychic
man.
Readings. These are apparently people who have been proven to have the gift. So there's good. I'm glad these are verified, certified psychics. That's good.
Absolutely.
Men's health, which is, you know,
euphemistic
that's a lot of things to do with, you know, stuff that we don't talk about on this podcast because Ronnie gets yelled at by his network director when we do.
That's right.
Dog food, Tractor Supply.
Nice.
Lowe's.
Nice.
Now, having just moved into a new house not too long ago, I can tell you, like, I might be at fault for this one. I've probably spent $2,000 at Lowe's easy in the last, you know, 2 weeks. So
I'm sure. Yeah.
Childhood learning groups. Now, this listener sent this one and said, hey, loved hearing this because I have referred people to this. I guess it helps people with early childhood development. They said, I've been referring people there for years. It's an awesome one. So, hey, we got one right.
Positive feedback. What a novel idea.
Yeah.
You know?
A local sexual performance clinic, which happens to be in the same business park as the listener who said, I had no idea it was there until I listened to your podcast. So that's handy.
Dude, can we do 10 seconds on just the phrase sexual performance? Whenever I hear that phrase, I always think of, like, a performance, but in the sort of, like, vaudevillian sense of, I always, like, see a guy in a top hat, like, kind of dancing across the screen with, like, a cane. You know what I mean? Like, and it always makes me laugh.
I believe they called those stag films.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, sexual performance.
Well, 10 seconds is up, which means
seconds is up.
Well, there's probably a performance joke to be made there too. Anyway.
Oh, I know.
Internet providers. Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
Everybody needs that. Construction software. That's very niche.
Yeah.
And then
construction software.
My favorite.
For all those contractors in our listener base.
We heard from a listener who is not a Spanish speaker, but does have a Spanish or Hispanic sounding last name.
Got it.
Who said that she is getting targeted ads in Spanish, like Spanish language ads. She goes,
what a time to
I don't know
life.
What these mean, but apparently when your last name is Reyes, they just assume you speak Spanish. So those are all ones that we've run across. And
interesting.
Just delightful.
Yeah, that's delightful. So here's my take on this. We're now like what, a decade into podcasts being a thing, give or take a year or two on either end. And I remember at the beginning of podcasts, it was sort of this breathless, like, oh, it's new and this is different than radio. It's a little more glib, a little more off the cuff. You can say whatever you want. There's no ads. And now we've just, we've sort of done this complete 180 into it sounding just like radio. And all the things that are annoying about radio are annoying about this, save for the fact that you can just skip the ads. But in every way, like the experience in the 90s of like driving around in your car, waiting for a song that you like to come on and kind of getting annoyed and rolling your eyes at all the ads and maybe even like turning down the volume while they were like the Menards ad played for like the 14th time in a row or whatever. That's the experience people are having now, except that they can skip it, which I guess is a good development. But
my favorite thing about this is that, I mean, just continuing the parallel is that, you know, one of the best and worst things about listening to the radio growing up was the hyper-local ads. You know, yeah. So Ted's Truck Stop or, like, the local car dealership, you know, where they're always yelling yeah. at you. Well, now with sort of the geolocation aspect of podcasts, we know where listeners are from, even if we don't know who you are. Advertisers can do the same thing. So they can invite you to, like, Mystic Lake Casino in the suburbs of Minneapolis if you're a listener in that area through our podcast. Yeah. And how great is that?
Yeah. Yeah. The interesting thing about this to me is like we always want to think of ourselves as like developing and evolving. And we always want to think of the thing that we're doing as genius. But in fact, this thing is exactly like the thing that local radio was doing in the 90s. You know, it's like we've ended up back there. Which is really funny to me. But Pipe, I want to talk about another media business thing, books. This is a thoughtful question from a listener, and you and I are both authors. We've been in the book business for a long time. Here's his question. You've mentioned several times, somewhat jokingly, including last night, he must have been at the live show, that there are too many writers and too many books written. My question is, if this is true, for what purpose do you add to that space? And additionally, what kind of writers slash books do you think the Christian realm still needs? So if the market is saturated, there's too many books, there's too many writers. Serious question by this guy. For what purpose do you add to that space? And additionally, what kind of writers and books do you think the Christian realm still needs? Interesting food for thought. What do you think, man?
I appreciate the question because the way that it was set up was also, it was a very non-cynical question. So it wasn't mm-hmm. Like, where do you get off yeah. writing books as much as if this is reality, how do you guys sort of process through this as you write? A couple things come to mind just context wise. The first is, no book has ever been written that is the final word on a subject.
That's true.
Either because no author is capable of doing that or because books go out of fashion. Books become old news. So even, you know, the best book on a subject kind of stops mattering after a certain period of time. And that period of time has gotten shorter. I think we talked about some of this at the live show where you get a classic book in the Christian realm. I think we talked about Knowing God by Packer, which had an enormous amount of influence for like 30 or 40 years.
Yeah.
Well, nobody today reads that book. Younger readers are not flocking to that book. So its influence is kind of lost. So generationally, we kind of need a new version of that. Readers read differently, and that's a plus and a minus. So, you know, a book that was 300 pages on the attributes of God probably isn't going to work nearly as well today as something written in a different format. So there's everybody is simply making a contribution. That's really how I think when I write. You know, if I'm writing, I don't think I'm going to write the final word on curiosity or happiness or being a pastor's kid.
Yeah.
I'm going to write a contribution on this. What do I have to offer? And then the other piece of it, though, is, you know, there's too many books and too many authors. I think we would both agree there's a lot of just bad writing out there. You do have to be able to self-evaluate and say, can I or can I not write better than what's out there? Can I match this or, you know, can I do better? And that was part of what got me into writing books in the first place, is that I was kind of I was working in publishing. I had sort of a critical mindset reading books mm-hmm. and going, this just isn't very good. And right. it got to the point where I was like, if I keep thinking this, at some point I have to prove that I can do better. And that was a piece of what tipped me going, I think I can. I think I can write 30,000 better words than whatever that is.
Yeah. No, that's a great word and a good take. You know, I think for me, yeah, the motivation's a little bit different. So I'll tell a quick story. I was at my son's school the other day. My son's a freshman in high school. But there are like littler kids at the school. And my pastor's son, his name's Nick. He's in like middle school. He, every time he sees me, he comes up to me. He's like, hey, when's your third graphic novel coming out? I'm like, oh, I don't know. He's like, I can't wait. Hurry up. And I always text my buddy, my pastor, and I'm like, man, Nick is such a stud. He's the best. He's like the last living human that still cares about my career, you know? But, you know, there's an aspect of that of, I know that people enjoyed previous things, and that compels me to want to do another thing. So there's that as one motivation. You know, another motivation, and you touched on this, was just the desire to do it better, the desire to write well, and the realization that, like, I think at any given time in the world, there's only X number of people who write really well. And you can move the needle a little bit with, like, teaching and classes and you know, people being really motivated and reading. But, like, I want to be one of the people that writes well. And while I'm in my window of being able to write well, I want to try a whole bunch of different things. I think where we get into problems and really where the spirit of the question is, and this is why I could never be an acquisitions editor. There's just kind of this like shotgun, scattershot approach to projects, right? I'm acquiring a whole bunch. I know that 2/3 of it isn't going to sell, but maybe we get lucky with some of it. Like, I'm doing ghostwriting projects now that I don't necessarily believe in them, but I don't not believe in them. You know what I mean? I'm not opposed to it. I'm like, this is morally neutral, so I'll say yes to it. But do I think it's the single greatest idea in the history of publishing? Nah, you know. But I hope it does well. You know, I have generally good feelings about it.
That's such an interesting mix, because as I was thinking about it, you know, there's at two ends of an extreme, I find writers very annoying. On one end, it's the totally idealistic writer who's just, this is, you know, this is, it's the book baby kind of thing where they're like, this is my heart and soul. All of my guts are in this. You know, if this gets criticized, it's like you just, you know, shot my middle child kind of thing. And I'm like, it's not. It's words on paper. It's not.
Right.
Like, yes, you do pour something of yourself into this.
Yeah.
But also, it's a product. You know,
it's a product. That's right. It's a $20 product or less.
And,
you know,
and the idea of people feeling like terrified to hit, you know, to kind of publish. I'm like, it isn't terrifying. Like, it becomes less terrifying when you realize, oh, the cost of this is actually really low. You know, if people
like, I'm going to spend more on like a box of hipster donuts in Vegas in 2 weeks than people will spend on my book. You know,
it hurts my feelings far more when, you know, or it hurts my heart a lot more to know that like I've offended my child or my wife and I are at odds than somebody doesn't like my book. I'm like, fine, it wasn't for you. You know, boo hoo. Then the other end of the spectrum. So you got this idealistic sense. The other end is the formulaic writing for money, you know, like I can crank this thing out and sell X copies and just kind of turn this is like the mega church pastor model. They don't do any of the work. They hire and I'm not crapping on ghostwriters per se, but like they hire a writer. Sometimes they even have a staff writer who takes their mediocre sermons and turns them into a mediocre book, which is going to sell 20 to 50,000 copies.
Yeah.
You know, just because it exists with a name on it.
Yeah. And that's like the churn and burn of our business. That's actually the part that they can count on the most, you know?
Yes.
And it's the most disillusioning part. Here's a question for you, Pipe. This is one that I've like found myself kind of grappling with over the last few years. I have no interest in discovering like new Christian writers, or really even new writers of any kind. Like, I'm teaching new writers in my classes, and that provides a certain kind of joy, and I'm always excited when they do well. But as far as like a new Christian book, a new author, like, I have zero interest in it. And I wonder if you can relate to that at all, or why that is, if you have thoughts on why it is.
Yeah, this attaches to something broader for me, which is that some of that I think is an age thing. Yeah. I'm not interested in new anything at this point. Like,
interesting.
So this morning, people will know when we're recording this, Kendrick Lamar released a new album. You know, there was a time where this would have mattered greatly to me because new albums, and I don't care. And it's not because of anything about him as an artist. I think he's probably the best rapper currently out there. But also I don't care. New is exhausting to me. But the other piece of it is just, I think marketing, which is funny because I was in marketing for a long time.
Yeah.
Marketing has turned me into a cynic. It takes an enormous amount of word of mouth recommendations to get me to actually believe that a book is genuinely great.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Because the influencer game, when you see 20 people who are like, love this new book from my friend so-and-so, I'm like, I don't believe any of you.
Exactly.
You all got the request to do this on this day at this time, and you did it. Good job.
Yeah.
Marketing copy is the same thing. Like, this is a tour de force. If I ever see tour de force, I'm like, that book stinks. I just assume it's trash. And so forth. So yeah, I don't bother to look for new. I'm exhausted by the idea of looking for new. What I do is I wait for people I trust. There just has to be sort of a critical mass of them going, this book is totally worth reading. For me to go, okay,
yeah,
I'll trust the enormity of you.
Yeah, it's interesting. So it begs the question, like, who is looking for new anymore? Because, you know, in my business, I deal with people who are 18 to 22. They're not looking for new authors. They're not discussing new authors. They're not getting excited about new authors. So it's not them. And I think to your point about marketing, there's this gross thing that's happening where a person's persona is getting conflated with the marketing side, and it's hard to extricate. So you get the author who's like, hey, everybody, I'm teaching myself to fly fish for my new book. It's research about my new book, you know, and it's just like, you want to jump through the screen and, you know, strangle that person because there's no extricating, you know, whatever is genuine about that person from, you know, the little seedlings of marketing, you know, genius that they think they're planting about their new book. And, you know, it's sort of like Ronnie's retreating dilemma. If everybody has a new book all the time, like, it's not special for anyone. And especially if you have a new book every 9 months, like clockwork, it's doubly not exciting. And this is like not a subtweet of Jared Wilson. Like, meeting Jared at the live shows, yeah, like, he was delightful. He was a really fun guy. And I left that experience going, if Ronnie wasn't monopolizing all his time, Jared and I could be good friends, you know, like, in another life, we would be buds.
So even
in another life, I would be interested in reading his books because I think he's a good writer, but I'm just not that interested. You know what I mean?
And I think Jared's an interesting case. And I think I can, you know, I know him a little bit. And we've talked about writing some and different things.
Yeah.
I think he splits the difference between product and idealism pretty effectively.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
On the one hand, he understands, like, writing is a source of income for him. You know, he's got multiple kids in college. So forth. Like, income matters. Selling your product matters. But the other thing is he, I think by his own admission, would kind of say he's not a one-trick pony, but he's kind of a one-message person, kind of angled in different ways. So he's going to shine this spotlight of, you know, the gospel of grace on different things.
Right.
And I don't think he is under any delusions that he's going to put out a book and he's like, this next one is not his New York Times bestseller.
Yeah.
This next one is a contribution to those who need to hear about the gospel in this area of life, or people who struggle with this thing, or who feel this way. And the fact that he's prolific is just kind of a it's just kind of unique in that way. I don't know if you can be kind of unique. I guess you're just unique or not. But like, I couldn't do what he does. Even if writing was my full-time job, I couldn't, I couldn't churn those things out. So he has a, he has an ability. I think you could.
Yeah.
You know, you,
no, and I did.
The way that, you write is different. But yeah, but he is not, you know, being angsty and sitting there going, why am I not getting the credit? Why am I not famous?
Right.
You know, I've written 20 whatever books. As much as he is going, I've put 20 pieces of what I hope is helpful, useful, maybe transformative into the world. And I'm just kind of praying them into the right people's hands, which I think that's a great way to go about it. I've done the same thing, except, you know, five times, not 20 whatever times. And I think that's a good splitting of the difference. And
I think it is too.
And I also think that shotgun approach you talked about earlier on the acquisition side, there's an element of that with authors as well. You know,
no, that's true. Yeah, for sure.
It's pretty rare to run across somebody like a novelist who we've talked about a lot, like Leif Anger, who puts out a novel like every 8 years.
I know.
And each one.
Hopefully
is,
we're due for another one soon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I guess it's been 6 or 7 years. That's about right.
Yeah.
And they pour themselves into something in such a way that, like, the next one is going to work because there's this anticipation.
Mm-hmm.
But I worked in acquisitions, and there is an element of kind of looking at it and going, well, this isn't for me and I don't love it, but I know who it is for and they might love it. Yeah. So we'll publish it.
Yeah.
And there's an element of writing. It can't be that. Like, you can't be writing something that you don't care about, but there is sort of a, like, if I publish 10 books, one of them is going to outsell the others by many factors.
Yeah.
Which is a weird reality, but it's true. Like, there's just usually the one of these things just finds a niche and kind of takes off a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. And it's a numbers game. Like, the more you try it, the more likely that is to happen. Pipe, let's take a break. I've got one more Jared C. thing to say, and then we'll get on to our next topic. All right. I think the thing for me that the Jared C. experience highlights, and really my own career has been like this too, and especially knowing you and knowing other writers, like, there are different ways to love writing. And just because a guy puts out a lot of product, it doesn't mean he loves writing. And like, I truly think Jared loves writing. I think he appreciates the craft. I think he takes it seriously. He is prolific. He works fast. I'm the same way. And I love it too. You know, I just have a high view of it. And I think where I get frustrated in thinking about industry stuff, it's when people seem like they want to just have a book deal to have a book deal. Like, it's a notch on their belt. And to me, that's a fundamentally kind of low view of writing. It's a low view of what we do. And I guess I'm more comfortable with somebody saying, I want to have a book deal because I don't know how to pay for my daughter's sophomore year of college any other way. I'm like, all right, fine. Yeah. Like, do your thing. I hope it goes well, you know, but somebody just kind of wanting it as a status symbol or wanting it as a flex, I think that's what I take umbrage with. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think ego is the worst reason to write.
Totally.
It's also the most common reason to publish, I should say. Writing, that's the thing, is most people want to be published. Most people don't want to be writers.
Yeah, that's true.
The actual grind of writing a book, like, we're going to get off this podcast and I have to go work on a book. And there's part of me that is very excited about this because I do love it. And there's part of me that dreads it because I've been sick for a few days. I've kind of gotten out of the rhythm. And it's like going back to the gym after you've been out for a while. You're like, oh, this stinks. I can't breathe. My muscles all hurt, except it's mental. And I think ego, the idea that having a book deal will change anything. The only people who have ever been impressed that I have a book deal are people who I don't care if they're impressed about me. Because it's almost
interesting.
It's almost always people who will never buy my books. They are miles away from the writing, reading world. You know, it's somebody you like meet through a friend of a friend at some like backyard barbecue. And they're like, oh, you're an author. That's really cool. What do you do? Kind of thing. And you tell them and they're like, oh. And so there's almost nothing to be gained by it. And I'm trying to, you know, you used it as sort of the feather in the cap. I think about like large church pastors or any pastor. It's probably a small church pastor thing too, who think if I getting a book deal is sort of the like the seal of approval on this ministry or something.
Right. Or it's validation that I'm someone.
Yeah. And
it's validation that I have a X number of people who care about what I do.
And man, unless you're the most like personality driven church ever, your church doesn't even care that you published a book.
That's very true.
I had a Bible study released recently through Lifeway on Ecclesiastes. It's one of the things I've written that I'm probably kind of most proud of because it was very different. Yeah. It was a lot of work. I love doing it. And it doesn't matter to most of the people in my church. And I'm not remotely offended by that. Because it's not really for them. It's for people who use these things in a certain way. They're all welcome to buy it and use it. But like, it's a small group study for groups who use something like that, and we do different things. And so, yeah, even that idea of like, this is the like, I've made it, except you haven't. Because your own people, your own staff members are kind of like, cool, I don't care.
Yeah.
Dude, what are we doing next?
That's such a great point. I think we're all chasing that feeling of having made it. And it's maybe incredibly audacious and kind of ridiculous to think that we deserve to feel that way. You know what I mean? Like, By and large, maybe your dad felt this way because your dad really did make it in a way that so many other people didn't. But I don't think that my dad ever felt like, oh, I've made it. You know, I've arrived as a pilot or whatever. You know, there was toil. There was, you know, there were thorns and thistles. This was work and life in a fallen world. And that's just what it was. And your dad probably felt that way too, as far as pastoral ministry. But yeah, we seem to be chasing this feeling of I've made it, which is going to deliver some ethereal sense of validation that we probably don't deserve, and that it's probably ridiculous to think that we do deserve. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's all a figment of our imagination. Like the idea of making it. Not to beat the Ecclesiastes drum too many times, but read Ecclesiastes and it will completely disabuse you of the notion of making it.
Yeah, very true.
And it doesn't say like life is pointless, but it does say, oh, you're not going to make it in this life.
Yeah.
There is no making it, which is one of the most helpful things for me as a writer, because what it does is it just sort of crystallizes the questions of why am I doing this? It cuts out a lot of the BS, and you go, well, there's no point in doing this for ego. It's foolish to do this for wealth. Now, maybe, you know, I'm going to get paid a little bit, but that's more just like, oh, that was nice. So why am I doing this? Am I doing this because God gave me a gift? Am I doing this to be helpful? Is there some legacy aspect of this? Like, there's something about putting things in writing and going, I'm leaving something behind that will outlast me. Like, that can be read when I'm not here or when I'm not around, those kinds of things. And it just sort of, it reduces your options down to what I think are much more valid reasons to be a writer when you kind of cut out that idea of making it, of succeeding, of being wealthy, of whatever, you know, being and just kind of going, well, those are off the table. So why am I really doing this?
Yeah, no, that's a good word. And I think the leaving something behind aspect of it is maybe the most attractive thing for me because, as I watch people in my life age, and I watch them decay, and their sort of intellectual acuity kind of degrades as they get older, and then people eventually die. Like, there's a sense of, I wish I could go back and experience them again when they were at their peak. And I think for a writer, there is a sense of, like, if you want to know what I was thinking about in 2006, you can read Facing Tyson and Why We're Not Emergent. And if you want to know where I was at in 2009, you can read Paper Tiger or whatever. It is kind of nice to know that those little breadcrumbs are out there for whoever cares enough to read them. And, you know, we don't delude ourselves into thinking that it's thousands or even hundreds of people who will. But I guess I like the idea of that being there. Pipe, let's take another quick break. We'll come back and hit one last topic. Okay, so we had another really intriguing listener-submitted one, which was this, Pipe. Some discussion about how older generations can better interact with younger generations without, quote, taking a crap all over them. So how do we talk about younger generations without just kind of defaulting into negativity. And we actually had a little bit of discussion about this in the text. You said, given that you teach a younger generation, this seems like something that you would have many thoughts about. And I do. We're at the end of a semester. It's been an especially trying semester, not because of any individual person, but just things that happen in the college business. And I am sometimes tempted to do this, but I'm reminded that, like, I really enjoy teaching young people. Like, the time in the classroom to me is the best time. It's the best part about being a college professor, and it's not even close. So I really enjoy them. I've always enjoyed them. I've enjoyed the banter, the conversation, whatever it is that young people bring to the table. I really get a kick out of it. But there are things that annoy me. But kind of in talking about it with you, I realized I'm really annoyed at their parents and not them. because I think the things that we attribute to them as annoying are really actually their parents' fault. Where are you at on the whole, like, talking about younger generations and being tempted to crap all over them thing?
Well, I'm with you in that when I interact with Gen Z, I think Gen Z is the current youngest sort of adolescent, college, whatever. I generally love it. The people are fantastic. When you talk about really a generation fun. And you get into, like, generational trends, it's so easy to be like, they are X. They're lazy, they're entitled, they're whatever. And by and large, that's true. I also think that almost all of those statements could be applied to every generation in history up through adolescence. You know, or maybe not history, but like the last 100 years. Every older generation thinks every younger generation is dumb and entitled. Every younger generation sees blind spots that every older generation has that the older generation just is unaware of. And so I'd say I'm caught in the middle of kind of constantly tempering myself and going, as annoying as they collectively might be, the test cases that I'm aware of are really promising. And at some point, it's going to be great to hand over ministry and business and my healthcare to, you know, these whippers.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree in general. And it's interesting. So one of the conversations I was having with a colleague about this is that, you know, when you went to college or when I went to college, there was a sense of we're going off to college. And you have this kind of tearful or overwrought goodbye with your parents, but then you're there. And you're there, you're getting in your car, you're driving places, you're doing things, you're going out with people. Maybe you're making out with a couple people, you know, like you're having all these experiences that are in every way untethered from your parents. Mm-hmm. And because of like long distance charges.
If you were making out with somebody and that was tethered to your parents, things just got real weird. I'm going to be.
Well, but here's the thing, man. Like in 2022, kids don't really go off to college. Like it's there's a feigned sense of independence, but it's really like if you're checking in with mom 14 times a day via your phone. And your mom can like surveil you via your phone. You haven't really gone off to college.
Right. Yes.
And a lot of the experiences that you and I were probably having at 15, like, I don't know, getting on your 10 speed and riding it, you know, 3 miles down to the grocery store to like play a video game in the lobby that you liked or to rent a movie or whatever. Like they haven't had those, you know, there haven't been a lot of, you know, beginning to snip the apron strings kind of experiences, which I think is both a function of technology, but also a function of like parents in our kind of subgenre, like high control has really never been questioned. And in fact, high control has been celebrated such that when they send their kid to Union or Taylor or Wheaton, you know, that kid hasn't had a lot of experiences. They haven't been independent much. And so you get a kid who really doesn't know how to be independent. And I think that leads to a lot of the stuff that we end up complaining about.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I saw a stand-up comedian. This is a joke that's been made 1,000 times, but this was the most recent iteration. He was talking about, you know, he was probably mid to late 20s. So, you know, millennial talking about how boomers criticize millennials for being the participation trophy generation. And he goes, I don't think that's fair. He said, we didn't choose to give ourselves these trophies. You did. You had such thin skin that you couldn't handle the reality that your kids sucked at t-ball, so you decided everybody needed a trophy, and now we get blamed for receiving these trophies. And and I go, which I think is kind of what you're saying. There's a we're blaming the kids for stuff that we have turned them into. And one of my proudest moments as a parent was, it was maybe 2 or 3 years ago, so it was middle school field day. My younger daughter goes to field day. She loves to compete at these things. She comes home, tosses a ribbon on the table and goes, can you believe this crap? They gave me a participation award. Throw that away.
Exactly.
And then proceeds to show me like her second and third place finishes at like the softball toss or whatever. But I was just like, this is amazing. She knows this is completely useless. Like she's got a future.
Yeah, she gets it. She gets it at a deep level. And the funny thing about right now is we're in, it's May, middle of May. This is the season of like end of school year ceremonies. And KK went to one yesterday at my kid's school where like, you know, everybody's getting an award and cum laude this. And these are high school kids, right? So it's like nobody cares. But we were talking about the fact that that ceremony exists solely to pleasure the parents, right? Like, the kids don't care if they get a sash. They don't care if, like, you know, they're cum laude at their little dorky Christian high school with 20 people in the graduating class. It's like, and none of these kids, and this is no disrespect to any of them, they're not remarkable. Like, they're all going to come to Union and be average and probably kind of forgettable. But, like, you know, in that ceremony, we're speaking of them as though they, like, just found the cure for cancer or whatever. And it's, that moment is manifestly about pleasuring people who are my age. And it begs the question, like, why are we so thirsty for this? Why do we need it?
Well, and where is the place of negative reinforcement? And I don't mean like, I'm not talking about degrading kids or being like the little league dad who's just, every time his kid strikes out, he's all up in his business. But we've just flipped to the point where saying, I'm sorry, that's not good enough, is now verbal violence instead of like, it's just accurate. That's not good enough.
Yeah.
And
you can't do it. Yeah. You know, you just can't.
The idea of, and the idea of like meets expectations should be good enough. So like, graduating from middle school or whatever, like you don't graduate from middle school. You just checked a box. You completed the necessary work to move on to the next thing. It becomes an accomplishment as you advance, you know?
No, that's right. Well, and I think this is actually kind of an elegant argument for why we still need sports. And like all the anti-sports ball people are rolling their eyes and harumphing, but sports is the ultimate definitive truth teller, right? Like if I had to, you know, line up at linebacker right now and cover Alvin Kamara out of the backfield on a wheel route, I couldn't do it. Like, you would know who the loser would be, and it would be fairly obvious. And there's something definitive and good about that. Like, nobody could come to the end of that rep and go, you know what? I don't care what anybody says. You did a fantastic job. As Kamara's, like, celebrating in the end zone over the, like, the corpse of my rep, you know? Like, no, nobody could say, hey, that was amazing, buddy. You know, good job. Yeah. In fact, I just voted you into the Pro Bowl. You're the best, you know? And I think there's a place for that, Pipe. And it's why I enjoy watching a pitcher and a hitter. It's a very truth-telling moment. Like, can I or can't I hit this guy's stuff? Or a boxer and another boxer. I'm drawn to these things. And they're the same things that I was drawn to when I was 9 years old, which is proof of I haven't evolved very much, I guess. But
I think millennials, so I'm a very old millennial, almost Gen X. You're Gen X.
Yeah.
I think millennials were set up for failure in this. You know, there's sort of the pendulum swing, like the greatest generation was so hard on our parents that our parents, you know, kind of coddled us. I think Gen Z is probably going to, that pendulum is going to start to swing the other way. Not that they're going to be hard, but like performance is going to matter to them.
Yeah.
I think the whole like safe space in colleges and whatever else, I think in the next 15, 20 years, there's going to be a shift away from that to like,
gosh, I hope so.
Yeah. Goodness. I hope so too. Or the rise in entrepreneurialism is like, that becomes cutthroat at some point. Because at some point, it's not about chasing your dreams. It's about, I have to be better than these other clowns to make any money. So it becomes performance-based. And there's just some, you know, there's a downside to that. But there's an upside. Like, so my older daughter is in the process of applying for jobs, seeking out jobs. And she's just kind of floating through the process as a 16-year-old will do on their first time through things. And I'm not, like, I'm giving her guidance, but she has to navigate every interview on her own. She has to make all the phone calls. She has to set up all the stuff, and it has been a bumpy ride, and she's getting better at it. And I just look at this and I go, I, you know, as much as I could probably do all this for her and have gotten her a job by now, like you said, she needs to go to college, and when she goes to college, I would like her to be gone and handle her business and reach out to a professor with questions and not have mommy or daddy do it and so forth.
So
and I think there's more and more parents kind of like us who are like, we need to make an adjustment here. We need to set our kids up for success. And so I think the future is bright. If not, the future is bright for those kids whose parents are doing that, because they're just going to walk all over the soft kids who can't take criticism.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. And we're starting to see some of that already, you know, even with the like boom in entrepreneurialism. There's kind of the reality in a market like Jackson, at least, like if you've got 15 hipsters making the same type of leather goods, like this market can really only support one and a half of them, you know, like, so that dream has to die. It has to get replaced by something else. And that's not a violent act, right? That's not like a threat or a trigger to someone. It's just the kind of the pragmatics of the market. And I think that's fine. I think the other funny like manifestation I'm seeing of like overcoddled young people is, in a weird way, they've become like bizarro old people. It's like they don't know how to attach a document to an email. They don't drive. I'm like, it's like I'm talking to my mom, you know, she's 75. This is weird. You know, you're 19. You should know how to like operate a motor vehicle and attach a thing to an email. It's just funny. But no, man, by and large, I love working with young people. I think there's hopefulness in it.
One last question on young people. So you teach 18 to 21 or 2 year olds.
Mm-hmm.
How, so, you know, we just trend towards curmudgeonliness when we talk about this.
Yeah.
How do you go into a classroom with 18 to 22 year olds? Like, kind of what's your mental space to be like, I want to build these kids up?
Yeah. I mean, I think when I talk about writing, it's always in terms of like building affection. And I think one of the great ways that we fail in the college business is getting to the end of it and having somebody be burned out on their craft. That is a failure on our part.
Hmm.
So if I'm not kindling affection for good writing, and if I'm not making that process joyful for them, then I'm really doing it wrong, you know, because writing is joyful for me and I have great affection for great writing. And if I can't convey that to them, then I'm really doing it wrong. I'm in the wrong business. And yet, like, across a lot of different disciplines, you meet these college kids who are just like, oh, I hate this. Harumph, I'm so burned out. And it's like, man, we're doing this wrong, you know? So for me, like, going into the classroom is an exercise in getting to know them better, enjoying who they are, asking lots of questions. And I think the other kind of outcropping of the super tight apron strings movement that we've been talking about is that these kids don't know how to talk. And I think to be a good journalist, you need to know how to talk. You have to know how to talk. You have to know how to listen. You have to know how to ask a question. You have to know how to like provide sort of white space for the other person to answer. I mean, there's a whole kind of artfulness to it. And I think a lot of times kids come to my classes and they realize the thing that they like the most is the talking. And it's really, really fun, man. And as I get older, I hope it continues to be fun. You know, and I think the fear in this for me every year that I get a little bit older is like, am I going to lose my relating to these kids fastball? And by God's grace, it hasn't happened yet, but I do fear that happening.
See, you know? I think you'll only lose it if you try to be cool. Whereas if you do what you're doing now, which is we're all here for one reason. You know, you think you might hate this reason. I think you can love this reason. Let's build adoration. Like, there's no reason you can't be, you know, one of the favorite professors at Union when you're 70. Because I remember at Wheaton, there were old professors who had nothing in common with young millennial kind of hot-headed students. But they were beloved because they engendered kind of adoration for the work, for the subject, for the you know, whatever it was we were invested in. And they clearly cared about us. They just didn't, they weren't trying to be one of us, because that would have been terrible.
Yeah. I mean, it's a Christian ideal, right? Like I think they loved you guys more than they loved themselves. And that's always attractive in a person. And whether that person's 75 or like the 29-year-old, like chiseled grad student, it really doesn't matter.
Right.
And connection means, you know, doing that at a high level. And if I'm walking with the Lord, then ostensibly I should be able to keep doing that at a high level, because I will continue to think more of them than I do myself. And that's an aspirational thing. Pipe, we've gone almost an hour on this program, and we've done what we always do in that we've wandered to and fro throughout some really pretty thoughtful topics. So shout out to our listeners for sending those in. Shout out to Salem Media for all the weird ads that you could skip if you want. And until next time.
We want to take a moment to thank the team at Life Audio for partnering with us on this podcast. Be sure to go to lifeaudio.com and take a look at the other podcasts in their network. They've got shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
The content we feed our minds will eventually show up in our lives. If we feed our minds the lies and confusion of this world, our lives will begin to reflect worldliness. But if we feed our minds the truth of the gospel, our lives will start to reflect the heart and character of Jesus. I'm John Stonge, and each week I host the Dwell on These Things podcast, where we take a deep look at the Word of God and learn what it means to apply it to our lives. We don't skip difficult passages, and we don't gloss over the truth. If you're looking for a show that will put your mind in a better place and help you understand God's Word with more clarity, you can listen to the Dwell on These Things podcast at lifeaudio.com or on your favorite podcasting app.